Welcome back to the second hour of today's edition of the Truth Jihad Radio Show in its new weekend time slot right here at We the People Radio Network. I'm Kevin Barrett. I'm now doing this show from 2 to 4 p.m. Central Time every Saturday and Sunday right here on WTPRN.com. And I'm on the web at BarrettForCongress.us. Right now I'm talking with Kevin Ryan. He's the former site manager for Underwriters Labs, who is fired for his whistleblowing about 9/11, and he's become one of the real scientific luminaries to be helping us understand what apparently really happened that day. Kevin, I think that, you know, we talked once, I remember, on the train from this, on the way to Denver, Colorado, and Boulder, where we were doing a talk out there with Steve Jones, and I remember being really impressed by what you had to say about the way 9/11 truth, unlike most so-called political issues, has a real potential to help people understand how they deceive themselves in all sorts of ways, not just political ways, but personal ways as well, and thereby it can be a tool of spiritual growth, and if that's what we're going to need if we're going to preserve our planet for future generations.
Yeah, I think that my view is that 9/11, the events of 9/11 are almost something of a gift to us. And I don't mean to disrespect the victims, of course. I think they've made, whether voluntarily or involuntarily, some of the greatest sacrifices of people in our time to help us use that, those events, to learn more about ourselves and how our minds work. Because really the problems that people see, a lot of them go back to people not being able to admit the truth about their circumstances and about their lives. And part of that is just, just the bending of truth in order to protect the self-image. And so I like to write and read about those things. I'm reading several books now that relate to that and trying to pursue that line of thinking and writing at my other blog at AmericanBuddhist.net, where people can go and see some of what I think 9/11 can be used for to create lasting positive change.
Okay, AmericanBuddhist.net. I'll have to check that out. In terms of bending the truth to help the self-image, that seems to be very noticeable to a lot of people who haven't really awakened to 9/11 yet. In terms of the Iraq War, so much death and destruction and suffering has resulted from that war, and it's very hard for people to admit that it was done for no good reason, certainly not the reasons we were told. Just for example, in my congressional race here, my opponent, Ron Kind, is a Democrat who keeps voting for the war to fund the war. But he always he makes this kind of mealy-mouthed excuse by saying that, well, he really didn't think it was a very good idea beforehand. But now that our troops are over there, he says, I'm going to keep voting to give them the tools they need to defend themselves. And these are votes, of course, that have nothing to do with giving the troops the tools they need to defend themselves. I mean, who would vote against that? But what he's implying, apparently, is that the votes against the war funding would, if we cut off funding for the war, according to this logic, the troops would all be left over there in Iraq without any food and water and, guns and, anything. They'd be left to hang out to dry, which is ridiculous. But for some reason, this kind of obvious lie hasn't been questioned at all by the media here, and it's very hard for people to see through it. And I guess that's just one example. I suppose that the reason people don't question it is that kind of lie is so common in political speech.
I think you're right. And with the Iraq War, as time goes on, those of us who are at least willing to think about it continually, there's very few people now who don't admit that the war in Iraq was built entirely on lies. And, some of us knew that those were lies at the time they were being told. that the evidence for weapons of mass destruction was forged, and that there were no, absolutely no connections between people who were really enemies, Hussein and bin Laden. So, you know, 9/11, though, the power of 9/11 is that we know that we are lied to by the government, certainly. We know that that we get fooled by them. But 9/11 is such an emotional turnkey for all of us. It's just so powerful still to this day. And it's still utilized by those who would essentially steal our freedom and kill our young soldiers and all the poor innocent people in these countries who just happen to live on the last remaining oil and natural gas. I mean, just the whole thing is so sadistic, and we've been part of it. So that's the power of 9/11, for us to wake up to that and say, how did this happen? How do we do that? How do we allow these this greedy few to abuse us so badly? And if, you know, with the World Trade Center, anybody really who is at least reasonably conscious has already seen that the stories given for the World Trade Center are completely false. There's been a long string of false stories. Clearly, there's something wrong there. And taken with the fact of our having invested everything in that false story, most people who've followed it understand and call for an end of the wars first. Of course, that would be my first priority. Let's bring our soldiers home right now. There's no, absolutely no excuse for not doing so. And a new investigation, in-depth investigation, a worldwide investigation of what happened on 9/11. And so, but for those people who need more evidence, we're working on it. You know, we will continue to work on it, and we will get as much of it together as possible as part of this independent investigation, with of course, no funding. But we will just go ahead and do it on our own, because we know why it is important. And I think you do. You know that as well, Kevin.
I certainly do. And I think there is some hope of getting a real investigation with some teeth in it, with subpoena power. There's, of course, the New York City 9/11 ballot initiative on the web at nyc911initiative.org. And that could conceivably produce such an investigation. And also, just yesterday, I was talking with Joel Hirshhorn, who's a metallurgical engineering professor who's also worked with the Office of Technology Assessment. And he's putting together a group of people who have already written legislation setting up a real 9/11 investigation. Joel's one of the people who came on board just this past year as far as speaking out about the controlled demolition of the World Trade Center. So he thinks that there is he'll have a shot at getting somebody on Capitol Hill to introduce this kind of legislation. Of course, if I beat Ron Kind, I would be the first to do that. But there may be some other folks who are not as knowledgeable and committed as I am on this issue who would also be willing to go along with such an investigation, especially since the co-chairs of the 9/11 Commission, Keenan Hamilton, have already admitted that the investigation was hobbled and flawed and they didn't get at the truth, and the military lied to them, and they were thinking about sending the military to court for perjury. So,
did I tell you, Kevin, that I met with Lee Hamilton a few months ago?
You might have mentioned that, yeah. So what did he have to say for himself?
Yeah, so a group of us here in Bloomington, we're the 9/11 working group of Bloomington, and we do a lot of research as a community group. We put on presentations every year. This year we'll have David Ray Griffin. Last year we had Richard Gage and Stephen Jones. But in May of this year, we did secure a meeting, a personal meeting, a couple of us, with Lee Hamilton, and expressed our displeasure with his report, and essentially just after doing so, listen to his string of excuses. I mean, he didn't really argue with the fact that his report was not worth much. He didn't really argue with that. He said, there was so much going on, and there was so much pressure, and you know, there were so many questions and just had all these excuses for why they weren't able to create a very good report. And one question that I asked him made him a little uncomfortable, and that was we had recently heard that Mr. Hamilton was agreeable to the idea that the military was lying to him and his commission about why the planes weren't intercepted. He kind of almost implies that a General Arnold of the Air Force was part of a group who were just simply lying to the commission. And I told him, well, I'm not sure that's true, and really actually got this information from David Griffin, that actually he was probably being lied to by Philip Zelikow and Stephen Cambone, not at all really by the military, but by specific people who had a specific agenda, and he got very uncomfortable. You could tell from the body language he shifted in his chair when I mentioned Cambone particularly. And he mentioned that he hired Philip Zelikow, which I think maybe is something of a self-deception in itself. But he believes he hired Philip Zelikow. He believes that that his commission did address World Trade Center 7 in the 9/11 Commission report, which we made clear to him that they did not. And just the fact that he didn't know that is kind of surprising. But
that is a little strange. You know, hiring Zelikow, though, kind of makes sense because Zelikow had written that, you know, in-depth article for Foreign Affairs magazine in 1998, talking about the likely political and cultural effects of a massive Pearl Harbor-style terrorist event, such as the destruction of the World Trade Center. So he,
right,
Zelikow, thought the whole thing through back in 1998. What better person could you have in charge of the investigation?
Yeah, but my point is, who hired who? You know, who was... Hamilton's the kind of guy who has, over the years, investigated major instances of government malfeasance, and in each instance has never found any evidence of government malfeasance. So, you know, he's just a guy they go to, they bring in when we need a cover-up, right? And Zelikow, on the other hand, is, I think, probably an active role player in the cover-up. He's not
a scriptwriter for 9/11 itself. I mean, he practically wrote the script for it in that Foreign Affairs article.
It seems so, yeah. Anyway, it was an interesting experience. We wanted to get the guy on stage with either us or David Griffin, and he has recently declined.
So doesn't shock me.
Yeah, right. Anyway, I thought you'd be interested in that.
Yeah, well, I think probably Thomas Keene would be a better bet. At least I think David Griffin also said that Thomas Keene has, you know, he doesn't have that record of cover-ups that Hamilton has, and he seems to be a little more forthcoming.
Well, why Hamilton is important is we live here in Bloomington, Indiana, in the center of Hamilton's congressional district. And he was a congressman here for 35 years in the 9th District of Indiana. And so what he now faces is a growing interest locally in these events. He faces the possibility of a local community resolution for a new 9/11 investigation in the middle of his district. And so, you know, I think for him, he definitely did think about how he would handle this, and perhaps still is, because I think it would raise for him a lot of uncomfortable questions among a lot of people that he knows personally.
That's a good point. And, you know, who knows when some of these people might actually turn a little bit. You know, people do change sometimes, under pressure especially. So,
we recently had a city council resolution passed to make sure that the federal government knows that our community does not support a war on Iran. So I think there are a number of communities around the country who are considering that such resolutions. They're non-binding, of course, but it's absolutely our right as citizens locally, as well as any other at any other level, to state that we are not in support of the ongoing wars or any new wars. So
right. And these wars really seem to be spreading now with the events in Georgia. It does seem that the Global Domination Project people may be accelerating their agenda a little bit, starting to go after the Russians and maybe the proxy, the war on Pakistan seems to be directed against China since Pakistan has been moving closer to China. And I notice a lot of the anti-war left is still, you know, only thinking about Iraq. A few of them have woken up to Iran, but very few of them understand the big picture, which is that this global domination group is out to conquer the world by military force, and they're willing to accept all sorts of suffering in order to do that.
Yeah, I agree. So I don't know if you want to get back to the investigation.
After this next break, let's do that. We're coming up on another break, but let's move back to the science when we come back. This is Kevin Barrett. I'm speaking with Kevin Ryan, the Underwriters Lab whistleblower and independent scientist working on destruction of the World Trade Center. You want to call in here? It is 512-646-1984. We'll be right back.
Uncover the Truth with Catherine Albright, live from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., Monday to Friday, right here on We the People Radio Network.
Welcome back. I'm Kevin Barrett, and you're listening to Truth Jihad Radio, right here on We the People Radio Network. I'm talking with Kevin Ryan, the Underwriters Lab whistleblower and 9/11 scientist, and we'll get back to some scientific topics. Kevin, I guess when we broke off, we were still talking about your paper on the top 10 connections between NIST and nanothermites, and some of those connections are very interesting. For instance, Richard Gann, the editor of the NIST report on the World Trade Center, managed the Next Generation Fire Suppression Technology Program alongside this Mizziolik guy, who's one of the world's leading experts on nanothermites. Yeah, and I'm wondering, you suggested that perhaps these nanothermites could have been sprayed on in the form of what would have been the same way that fire suppression stuff like asbestos is sprayed on to the building or onto the
spreader. I think I lost you for a minute there, Kevin, but I'm back. You were talking about Richard Gann and how he had a very interesting next generation fire suppression technology program, and he had working on that project, one of the other lead experts on nanothermites, can't even pronounce the guy's name, Mizziolik. And
right.
But I think in that paper, what was most intriguing to me, the thing was the number of and the types of contractors that were hired by a certain organization called the Naval Surface Warfare Center in Indian Head. NSWC, Naval Surface Warfare Center in Indian Head, Maryland. And they are one of the top organizations, if not the most experienced organization on the development of energetic materials. Back in 1999 and 2000, they started making this high-tech nano-aluminum at their own site and distributing it to Lawrence Livermore and others. And they hired, they had this project for demolition materials. They hired a company that supplied demolition materials. They hired Mantech, which is Richard Armitage's company, Titan, James Woolsey's company, Booz Allen Hamilton, Battelle, as we talked about, SAIC. All these very interesting organizations working together 1999 and 2000. And why that's interesting, of course, is because we recently, in the last year or so, noticed the connection to the fireproofing upgrade work that was done at the World Trade Center in 1999 and 2000, and how the application of this upgraded fireproofing matched essentially exactly with the floors of impact and failure in the towers. So, you know, the odds of that are very low. If you look at the North Tower, the floors that were upgraded match absolutely exactly where the plane hit, where the fires existed, and where the accordion-like collapse began, at least after the antenna dropped.
And would they have needed to work more on that particular floor to create the fireball and the lasting fires there and the initiation of the demolition as opposed to, I mean, obviously they couldn't have demolished
right.
the building simply by working on these floors. They would have had
right.
things on other floors too. But
right. So there were.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely, Kevin. That's a good point. There are actually three areas of the building that have. The greatest interest, the impact supposed failure zone, apparent failure zone is what I should say, the core of the building, and, of course, there was work being done there as well in the 9 months before 9/11 by a company called Ace Elevator, and also the basements of the building. And I think if you look at the testimony of people like William Rodriguez, you should be quite interested in what happened in the basement of the building. And Richard Gage has mentioned that the Ace Elevator connection is very compelling as well. We would need to get to the core of the building. If we wanted to demolish these buildings, we would need to get underneath them. But really, not every floor needed to be attacked as far as you know, applying of nanothermites. Nanothermites would be useful for several reasons: to create an explosive effect, to create an incendiary fire where there shouldn't have been fire, and also just to make it look like where the planes impacted was the most important section of the building. So anyway, that paper, I think, is just it's the beginning of a track of investigation where I think it's important we look at who had access to this technology, who had access to the buildings, and try to make connections between them and the people who did the investigation, because the investigation itself is a huge crime. It's a cover-up. I mean, clearly now, the investigations into 9/11 were a cover-up. And that in itself makes for, in my mind, a bigger crime, a greater crime, than the crimes of 9/11. Many more people have been killed because of this cover-up. So we're trying that parallel track as well. But we have a new paper, if you'd like to talk about the environmental anomalies.
Sure, yeah, because that actually ties in. Once again, that paper does seem to be pointing towards the likelihood of the use of these nanothermites.
Yes, exactly. We submitted this paper. Again, I have to thank my great co-authors. James Gourley is a chemical engineer and attorney from Texas. And, of course, Stephen Jones, who's really the leader of the independent investigation and can't be thanked enough by all of us. And those are my two co-authors on this paper. And it began as an investigation into environmental data. We put in a FOIA request because of certain unusual indicators in the environmental data, the few that were reported publicly. And we got back a CD of data, a huge amount of data, and began taking a look at that data systematically. One thing we did is take a look at the locations, the sampling locations, in particular at Ground Zero. So Austin Toba Plaza, the North Tower and the South Tower sampling locations, and started trending those chronologically, looking for the detections of a number of chemical analytes. What we saw was really startling spikes in detection. First of all, they were quite high levels of what are called volatile organic chemicals. So things like benzene and styrene, toluene. These are generally products of combustion of plastic. And also you find benzene in the smog and traffic exhaust, but at much lower levels than were seen at the World Trade Center. And really, the World Trade Center levels of these chemicals were much higher than what we found in other structure fires. There was, for example, the Plastimet fire in Ontario, which essentially was a plastics factory on fire, had much lower levels of these chemicals than were seen at the World Trade Center. At least in these very sharp spikes, that's what we see in the data. So we trend it chronologically, and we see these extreme spikes rising up and falling down within a day or so for all of those chemicals all at once. So,
And we'll talk about how that might be explained when we come back. This is Kevin Barrett. I'm talking with Kevin Ryan about scientific work towards understanding what happened to the World Trade Center. We shall return.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to Truth Jihad Radio right here on We the People Radio Network. I'm talking today with Kevin Ryan, the 9/11 whistleblower fired from Underwriters Labs for asking some hard questions. And he's still asking hard questions. And right now we're talking about this recent paper on the environmental anomalies at the World Trade Center, evidence for energetic materials meaning such as thermate. And Kevin, some of these spikes were pretty huge, it appears. For instance, you point out that benzene is a volatile organic chemical that can cause very serious health effects at 100 parts per billion, that there was a spike in November, long after any fossil fuel fires would have presumably died out, that it was up to 180,000 parts per billion, almost 2,000 times the level that would be damaging to people's health. But how can such massive spikes as these have happened?
Well, that's what we're trying to enlighten people about. There are a couple of possibilities, but both of them relate to thermitic or aluminothermic materials, energetic materials. And so we talked about thermite and thermate as being materials that have their own fuel and oxidant contained within, like gunpowder is an energetic material. It has no need for oxygen from the atmosphere in order to burn. And when ignited, it's a pretty exothermic or violent fire. So benzene is, as I said, it's a combustion product from the burning of plastics. It also relates to one of the other very unusual species found at the World Trade Center in the air emissions, and that's a chemical called 1,3-diphenylpropane. Now, I'm very interested in this chemical, and the reason for that is because 1,3-diphenylpropane is also associated with nanocomposite materials. Like those that are used to create nanothermites. And 1,3-diphenylpropane is used in these nanocomposites in order to control the pore size of the silica nanostructure. And I know that's a little bit of a technical description, but essentially the pore size of silica nanocomposites is what can be, if it can be controlled, is what can allow the optimization of an explosive material built on that nanocomposite. So 1,3-diphenylpropane was found at levels, according to the EPA, that dwarfed all others, and they're, in quote, dwarfed all others in their measurements. It also was found to be pervasive, they said. And they tried several explanations, and as we go through those explanations in the paper, we find that they are not very probable or totally improbable explanations. Whereas the possibility that 1,3-diphenylpropane is part of a nanocomposite buried within the rubble piles seems to be a stronger hypothesis. And I know that we haven't said who made this nanocomposite as yet, but we're working on that, of course, as we discussed earlier. 1,3-diphenylpropane, when it is itself combusted, when it goes through thermolysis, has products of toluene and styrene, and high-temperature oxidation of toluene produces benzene. So benzene, toluene, and styrene could all come from the high-temperature exposure of 1,3-diphenylpropane or combustion of 1,3-diphenylpropane. So, you know, there are two possibilities for the benzene. We could have had a thermitic reaction, thermite, even macrothermite, even a typical thermite mixture could have been buried within the pile and caused these extremely violent fires that raged for a day or so and then fell back down to nothing or to reasonably lower levels. Or we could have had this 1,3-diphenylpropane buried in a nanocomposite that was being heated and combusted and creating these materials, toluene, styrene, and benzene. But some of the other chemicals found, and this is not just EPA data. Now, we go into data from the University of California, Davis. We had aerosol measurements made by Thomas Cahill and his team about a mile or so from Ground Zero in October. And they saw, again, they saw spikes of these unusual materials. What do they see? They saw sulfur spiking and silicon spiking, and so they didn't test for the exact compounds of the silicon and the sulfur. So they did elemental analyses, but they addressed these very poorly. They talked at first they talked about high temperature fires in the pile, and that's what we've seen, of course, and there's a paper at the Journal of 9/11 Studies that addresses extreme temperatures at the World Trade Center. But Cahill and his team backed away from that explanation, and I don't know why, but it's interesting that they published their last paper at Lawrence Livermore National Labs. But they backed away from that in favor of a theory of anaerobic incineration.
How does that work? I thought that incineration means fire, and fire involves oxygen, but anaerobic means there's no oxygen. So I don't understand.
it seems to be something of a tap dance, and I have a feeling that Cahill had a growing knowledge of what he was dealing with over time and perhaps was enlightened by his colleagues at Lawrence Livermore when they finally put out their paper 2 years later. They came up with this anaerobic incineration explanation, and the idea was that in order to explain these really rare metals that were showing up in the data, they went to the literature and found some data from municipal incinerators where oxygen depleted environments can create volatilized metals under conditions of 10% chlorine. And so it's a really becomes a very delicate and complicated explanation. But what he's essentially saying is that in the fires somewhere, there were, of course, chlorinated species, and that's true, that would have formed chlorides like metallic chlorides, in this case, to explain the rare metals he saw, like vanadium, we would have had to have vanadium chloride form. But vanadium, the only source Cahill gave was the diesel fuel oil. And, of course, that was only under World Trade Center 7 on the other side of the street from the towers. So it becomes a pretty complicated scenario in which chlorinated metals were formed, and then they had to be converted to oxides as they reached the surface again, and then, of course, travel a mile to show these extreme levels at Cahill's detector. And what we hypothesize, a much simpler hypothesis, is simply the presence of energetic materials, because, of course, sulfur is a component of thermate, the aluminothermic material. Silica is the structural base of nanocomposites and nanothermites. Vanadium is one of the metals used in nanothermites, as well as copper and some of the other metals that Cahill found to be at unusual levels and spiking. So we feel that our hypothesis of energetic materials, now I'm particularly partial to the nanothermites, but I'm also, of course, very interested in the possibility that both nanothermites and more typical thermite mixtures were present at the World Trade Center. We feel that this hypothesis explains all of this data and does so much more, much better than either EPA or UC Davis have even come close to.
Well, normally the simpler hypothesis that passes the test of Occam's razor, along with the hypothesis that explains all of the data, is supposed to be the one that you accept. It seems like that hasn't entirely happened with these mainstream and official scientists, but hopefully we're getting there. This is Kevin Barrett. I'm talking with Kevin Ryan, the Underwriters Lab's whistleblower. We'll be back in a moment.
Online and on demand, this is We the People Radio Network.
Welcome back. This is Truth Jihad Radio on We the People Radio Network. I'm Kevin Barrett, and today I'm talking with Kevin Ryan, who was fired from his job at Underwriters Laboratories for asking some tough questions about the destruction of the World Trade Center. And he's still asking tougher and tougher and tougher questions, and the opposition is reeling. Kevin, we've just been talking about this latest peer-reviewed paper on the chemical residues found, or the environmental anomalies, shall we say, after the destruction of the World Trade Center. And as you said, the evidence is really settling down and pointing to the simplest explanation is the very high temperatures in the rubble. And of course, we've already seen the evidence for that in another Journal of 9/11 Studies paper. And the use of these energetic materials such as nanothermites. Things are moving along, and I understand that you're working on more papers. Can you discuss the publications that may be coming out in the future?
Well, briefly I can. There is a paper that I'm not the first author on, but a co-author, and Stephen Jones is the first author. It has been submitted to Mainstream Journal. It is really an excellent paper, as all Stephen Jones papers tend to be. Very compelling, very accessible. It does have a number of analytical techniques involved, so we do try to explain those so that people can understand what we're doing. But basically what we're looking at is the World Trade Center dust, samples independently collected by quite a few collectors now, and signed affidavits, chain, legal chain of custody as necessary. And we're looking at the samples for several things. We've seen these microspheres, of course. Stephen Jones has been reporting on those for some time now. Stephen presented at the Boston conference last year with myself, Richard Gage, and Joel Hirshhorn, by the way.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah. He Stephen presented his findings on these red gray chips. They're ferromagnetic chips, meaning they're attracted to a magnet, and they therefore contain most likely iron, possibly also nickel, and enough in order to be able to move the entire chip toward the magnet. They have been analyzed and reported to contain aluminum and oxygen, silicon, some carbon, and essentially all of the elements that you would find in a nanothermite-like material. So there is a lot more to the paper. I don't want to
Those chips almost look like uncombusted thermite, don't they?
That's what they look like, yeah. And there are a lot of analytical techniques being used. There are scientists now around the world who are involved in the investigation. As I said, Professor Jones is leading the investigation and doing an excellent job of it. But, his paper, where he's the first author, makes some really inarguable points and comes to strong conclusions. So whereas the environmental paper kind of offered up this more likely scenario, more a strong hypothesis, Stephen's new paper really comes to a strong conclusion. And I think we can safely say, and probably could have said by now, that the demolition hypothesis is really a theory now. It's the only thing that even comes close to explaining the destruction of the World Trade Center buildings. And there's so much evidence now in favor of that theory that it's really the only thing we have as an explanation. And at this point, I don't think that anyone can deny that. And after these next few papers are published, I've got another one that's supportive of Stephen's paper, doing some analytical work. And I think it's also very compelling. As I told you, I'm making nanothermites myself, and that's going to be part of upcoming papers. So I think we're going to put a nail in this one pretty soon, Kevin.
Well, hey, I'll be looking forward to that. I still remember a few years ago when David Griffin gave that talk in New York. I believe that was in fall or maybe summer to fall of 2005. It was after he'd given his talk here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison that got broadcast nationwide on C-SPAN. He went to New York and he gave that talk where he said, look, this demolition hypothesis really isn't just one hypothesis anymore. It's pretty well a fact. And more and more people have concluded that, and you know, you're nailing it down now with really intense and precise scientific work. How long do you think it'll take for history and journalism to catch up with this?
Well, it might not take very long, depending on circumstances, in my view. So, you know, if there's another major terrorist attack, I think that at this point there are enough people around the world who have enough knowledge of the alternative theory that it will bring them quickly to the question of who really did this, right?
Right.
And so that may be an instantaneous turning point. On the other hand, I think if we have a kind of a slow burn here for a while, that I think it'll be not too long, not nearly as long as it took for the JFK investigators to prove that the magic bullet wasn't really possible. Now, that doesn't mean there was ever a JFK investigation that led to the truth, at least internationally recognized, but I think that there's a possibility now with the growing 9/11 truth movement in Europe, and some of our fellow scientists are Europeans, that we will get people to understand in time, hopefully, that the events of 9/11 are critical. Understanding them are critical to the future of all people. So,
well said. Hey, we do have a caller. It's Jeffrey from Kentucky. He'll have a couple of minutes to get in that question. Hello, Jeffrey. How are you?
Hey, gentlemen. Hey, I'd just like to say thanks for what y'all are doing, and I noticed the phone lines have been quiet today, so I'm just saying that this is kind of like what happens when you're in your class and your professor's talking. You be quiet and you listen until it's all over with, and then you make your comment. So keep up the good work, all right?
Hey, thanks, Jeffrey. Appreciate it.
Yep.
Okay, take care. So, yeah,
so,
I'm glad to hear that folks out there are listening. And, you know, I've certainly learned a lot from you in many ways. And I agree completely. I think getting to the truth of this and having it publicly understood and publicly professed and correcting the history books is absolutely crucial. And I agree that we're on the road to getting there.
Yeah, we're doing what we can. And, of course, we know that you are as well, Kevin. And, you know, like our other heroes, Carol Brulé and others running for Congress and Cynthia McKinney running for president and others, you know, we just wonder what we can do for you, how the campaigns are going, and I'd be glad to do what I can to try and move those along as well.
Well, thanks, Kevin. Appreciate it. Yeah, it's going pretty well. You know, when I've settled on a strategy, you know, you kind of have to focus things in a political campaign. So I've settled on a peace and truth strategy. That's my slogan, peace and truth. And most people can buy into the idea that that this war was launched on lies. So that, you know, connecting those dots works really well, especially because my opponent, Ron Kind, is a pro-war Democrat who's disguised his pro-war stance by basically lying and saying, oh, I'm just voting to give money to the troops so they can defend themselves over there, so they'll have the tools to defend themselves. And that's, you know, he's painting a target on his back when he says that, because, you know, he's pro-war and mealy-mouth, not telling the truth, and so that opens him up to a peace and truth approach. He's already promised that he will debate me, so that should be a very interesting debate.
Yeah, I'd really be glad to hear that one, and, you know, Madison is not far from Bloomington, so maybe I'll come up for it.
Okay, sounds good. It'd be great to have you there. In fact, maybe if he starts to, you know, come after me on 9/11, maybe I'll have to bring you up to set him straight on some of the fine points.
Hey, sounds good.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
Well,
anyway,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, I was just going to tell you, thank you so much for coming on. We're coming up here on the final Face the Music moment. But, hey, keep up the terrific work. I'm a huge fan of yours and have been ever since the Underwriters Lab thing broke. And all I can say is keep it up, and let's I'll see you at the victory party.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin.
Okay, take care. That was Kevin Ryan, one of our heroes of 9/11 truth, one of the probably less known and most important people working to get the truth out about 9/11. Okay, well, stick around. Tomorrow we're going to have a surprise mystery guest. Same time, same channel, 2 to 4 p.m. Central, right before Alex Jones. So until then, keep on struggling for truth.